any account of the methods of government which developed under the National Coalition would be incomplete without an explanation of the series of personal messages which I sent to the President of the United States and the heads of other foreign countries and the Dominion governments. This correspondence must be described. Having obtained from the Cabinet any specific decisions required on policy, I composed and dictated these documents myself, for the most part on the basis that they were intimate and informal correspondence with friends and fellow workers. One can usually put one's thought better in one's own words. It was only occasionally that I read the text to the Cabinet beforehand. Knowing their views, I used the ease and freedom needed for the doing of my work. I was, of course, hand in glove with the Foreign Secretary and his department, and any differences of view were settled together. I circulated these telegrams, in some cases after they had been sent, to the principal members of the War Cabinet, and, where he was concerned, to the Dominion's Secretary. Before dispatching them, I had, of course, had my points and facts checked departmentally, and nearly all military messages passed through Ismay's hands to the Chiefs of Staff. This correspondence in no way ran counter to the official communications or work of the ambassadors. It became, however, in fact, the channel of much vital business and played a part in my conduct of the war, not less, and sometimes even more important, than my duties as Minister of Defense. The very select circle who were entirely free to express their opinion were almost invariably content with the drafts and gave me an increasing measure of confidence. Differences with American authorities, for instance, insuperable at the second level, were settled often in a few hours by direct contact at the top. Indeed, as time went on, the efficacy of this top-level transaction of business was so apparent that I had to be careful not to let it become a vehicle for ordinary departmental affairs. I had repeatedly refused the requests of my colleagues to address President Roosevelt personally on important matters of detail. Had these intruded unduly upon the personal correspondence, they would soon have destroyed its privacy and consequently its value. My relations with the President gradually became so close that the chief business between our two countries was virtually conducted by these personal interchanges between him and me. In this way, our perfect understanding was gained. As head of the state, as well as head of the government, Roosevelt spoke and acted with authority in every sphere. And carrying the War Cabinet with me, I represented Great Britain with almost equal latitude. Thus, a very high degree of concert was obtained, and the saving in time and the reduction in the number of people informed were both invaluable. I sent my cables to the American Embassy in London, which was in direct touch with the President at the White House through special coding machines. The speed with which answers were received and things settled was aided by clock time. Any message which I prepared in the evening, in the night, or even up to 2 o'clock in the morning would reach the President before he went to bed. And very often his answer would come back to me the next morning. In all, I sent him 950 messages and received about 800 in reply. I felt I was in contact with a very great man who was also a warm-hearted friend and the foremost champion of the high causes which we serve. The Cabinet being favorable to my trying to obtain destroyers from the American government, I drafted during the afternoon of May the 15th my first message to the President since I became Prime Minister. To preserve the continuity of our correspondence, I signed myself Former Naval Person, and to this fancy I adhered almost without exception throughout the war. "Although I have changed my office," I wrote, "I am sure you would not wish me to discontinue our intimate private correspondence. As you are no doubt aware, the scene has darkened swiftly. The enemy have a marked preponderance in the air, and their new technique is making a deep impression upon the French. I think myself the battle on land has only just begun, and I should like to see the masses engage. Up to the present, Hitler is working with specialized units in tanks and air. The small countries are simply smashed up one by one like matchwood. We must expect, though it is not yet certain, that Mussolini will hurry in to share the loot of civilization. We expect to be attacked here ourselves, both from the air and by parachute and airborne troops in the near future, and are getting ready for them. If necessary, we shall continue the war alone, and we are not afraid of that. But I trust you realize, Mr. President, that the voice and force of the United States may count for nothing if they are withheld too long. You may have a completely subjugated, Nazified Europe, established with astonishing swiftness, and the weight may be more than we can bear. All I ask now is that you should proclaim non-belligerency, which would mean that you would help us with everything short of actually engaging armed forces. Immediate needs are, first of all, the loan of 40 or 50 of your older destroyers to bridge the gap between what we have now and the large new construction we put in hand at the beginning of the war. This time next year we shall have plenty. But if in the interval Italy comes in against us with another 100 submarines, we may be strained to breaking point. Secondly, we want several hundred of the latest types of aircraft, of which we are now getting delivery. These can be repaid by those now being constructed in the United States for us. Thirdly, anti-aircraft equipment and ammunition, of which again there will be plenty next year, if we are alive to see it. Fourthly, the fact that our ore supply is being compromised from Sweden, from North Africa, and perhaps from northern Spain, makes it necessary to purchase steel in the United States. This also applies to other materials. We shall go on paying dollars for as long as we can, but I should like to feel reasonably sure that when we can pay no more, you will give us the stuff all the same. Fifthly, we have many reports of possible German parachute or airborne descents in Ireland. The visit of a United States squadron to Irish ports, which might well be prolonged, would be invaluable. Sixthly, I am looking to you to keep the Japanese quiet in the Pacific, using Singapore in any way convenient. The details of the material which we have in hand will be communicated to you separately. With all my good wishes and respect. On May the 18th, a reply was received from the President welcoming the continuance of our private correspondence and dealing with my specific requests. The loan or gift of 40 or 50 older destroyers, it was stated, would require the authorization of Congress, and the moment was not opportune. He would facilitate to the utmost the Allied governments obtaining the latest types of United States aircraft, anti-aircraft equipment, ammunition, and steel. In all this, the representations of our agent, the highly competent and devoted Mr. Purvis, presently to give his life in an air accident, would receive most favorable consideration. The President would consider carefully my suggestion that a United States squadron might visit Irish ports. About the Japanese, he merely pointed to the concentration of the American fleet at Pearl Harbor. On May 13th, I asked the House of Commons, which had been specially summoned, for a vote of confidence in the new administration. After reporting the progress which had been made in filling the various offices, I said, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. In all our long history, no Prime Minister had ever been able to present to Parliament and the nation a program at once so short and so popular." Upon these simple issues, the House voted unanimously and adjourned till the 21st of May. Thus, then, we all started on our common task. Never did a British Prime Minister receive from Cabinet colleagues the loyal and true aid which I enjoyed during the next 5 years from these men of all parties in the state. Parliament, while maintaining free and active criticism, gave continuous, overwhelming support to all measures proposed by the government, and the nation was united and ardent as never before. It was well indeed that this should be so, because events were to come upon us of an order more terrible than anyone had foreseen.
Winston Churchill, Prime Minister. Here is his speech to the House of Commons on May 13th, 1940, followed by his broadcast to the world, "Be Ye Men of Valor," on May 19th, 1940.
Mr. Speaker, on Friday evening last, I received His Majesty's commission to form a new administration. It was the evident wish and will of Parliament and the nation that this should be conceived on the broadest possible basis, and that it should include all parties, both those who supported the late government and also the parties of the opposition. I have completed the most important part of this task. A war cabinet has been formed of 5 members, representing, with the Liberal opposition, the unity of the nation. The 3 party leaders have agreed to serve either in the war cabinet or in high executive office. The 3 fighting services have been filled. It was necessary that this should be done in one single day, on account of the extreme urgency and rigor of events. A number of other key positions were filled yesterday, and I am submitting a further list to His Majesty tonight. I hope to complete the appointment of the principal ministers during tomorrow. The appointment of the other ministers usually takes a little longer, but I trust that when Parliament meets again, this part of my task will be completed and that the administration will be complete in all respects. Sir, I considered it in the public interest to suggest that the House should be summoned to meet today. Mr. Speaker, I agreed and took the necessary steps in accordance with the powers conferred upon him by the resolution of the House. At the end of the proceedings today, the adjournment of the House will be proposed until Tuesday, the 21st of May, with, of course, provision for earlier meeting if need be. The business to be considered during that week will be notified to members at the earliest opportunity. I now invite the House, by the resolution which stands in my name, to record its approval of the steps taken and to declare its confidence in the new government. Sir, to form an administration of this scale and complexity is a serious undertaking in itself. But it must be remembered that we are in the preliminary stage of one of the greatest battles in history, that we are in action at many points in Norway and in Holland, that we have to be prepared in the Mediterranean, that the air battle is continuous, and that many preparations have to be made here at home. In this crisis, I hope I may be pardoned if I do not address the House at any length today. I hope that any of my friends and colleagues or former colleagues who are affected by the political reconstruction will make all allowances for any lack of ceremony with which it has been necessary to act. I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might, with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. For without victory there is no survival. Let that be realized. No survival for the British Empire. No survival for all that the British Empire stood for. No survival for the urge and impulse of the ages that mankind will move forward towards its goal. But I take up my task with buoyancy and hope. I feel sure that our cause will not be suffered to fail among men. At this time, I feel entitled to claim the aid of all. And I say, come then, Let us go forward together with our united strength.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. A tremendous battle is raging in France and Flanders. The Germans, by a remarkable combination of air bombing and heavily armored tanks, have broken through the French defenses north of the Maginot Line, and strong columns of their armored vehicles are ravaging the open country, which for the first day or two was without defenders. They have penetrated deeply and spread alarm and confusion in their track. Behind them, there are now appearing infantry in lorries, and behind them again, the large masses are moving forward. The regroupment of the French armies to make head against and also to strike at this intruding wedge has been proceeding for several days, largely assisted by the magnificent efforts of the Royal Air Force. We must not allow ourselves to be...
The speech then continued.
Having received His Majesty's commission, I have formed an administration of men and women of every party and of almost every point of view. We have differed and quarreled in the past, but now one bond unites us all to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be. If this is one of the most awe-striking periods in the long history of France and Britain, it is also, beyond doubt, the most sublime. Side by side, unaided except by their kith and kin in the great dominions, and by the wide empires which rest beneath their shield. Side by side, the British and French peoples have advanced to rescue not only Europe, but mankind from the foulest and most soul-destroying tyranny which has ever darkened and stained the pages of history. Behind them, behind us, behind the armies and fleets of Britain and France, gather a group of shattered states and bludgeoned races, the Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Dutch, the Belgians, upon all of whom the long night of barbarism will descend, unbroken even by a star of hope, unless we conquer, as conquer we must, as conquer we shall. Today is Trinity Sunday. Centuries ago, words were written to be a call and a spur to the faithful servants of truth and justice. Arm yourselves and be ye men of valor, and be in readiness for the conflict, for it is better for us to perish in battle than to look upon the outrage of our nation and our altars. As the will of God is in heaven, even so let him do.
The Battle of France and the March to the Sea.
During the night of the 9th, 10th of May, heralded by widespread air attacks against airfields, communications, headquarters, and magazines, all the German forces in the Bock and Rundstedt army groups sprang forward towards France across the frontiers of Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg. Complete tactical surprise was achieved in nearly every case. Out of the darkness came suddenly innumerable parties of well-armed, ardent storm troops, often with light artillery, and long before daybreak, 150 miles of front were aflame. Holland and Belgium, assaulted without the slightest pretext or warning, cried aloud for help. The Dutch had trusted to their waterline. All their sluices, not seized or betrayed, were opened, and the Dutch frontier guards fired upon the invaders. The Belgians succeeded in destroying the bridges of the Meuse, but the Germans captured intact two across the Albert Canal. At 5:30 a.m. on May the 10th, Lord Gort received a message from General George ordering alert 1, 2, and 3, namely instant readiness to move into Belgium. At 6:45 a.m., General Gamelin ordered the execution of Plan D and the long-prepared scheme of the French High Command, to which the British had subordinated themselves, came at once into action. Mr. Colline, when a Dutch Prime Minister, he visited me in 1937, had explained to me the marvelous efficiency of the Dutch inundations. He could have explained by a telephone message from the luncheon table at Chartwell, press a button, which would confront an invader with impassable water obstacles. But all this was nonsense. The power of a great state against a small one, under modern conditions, is overwhelming. And the Germans broke through at every point, bridging the canals or seizing the locks and water controls. In a single day, all the outer line of the Dutch defences was mastered. The case of Belgium requires more searching statement. Several hundreds of thousands of British and French graves in Belgium mark the struggle of the previous war. The policy of Belgium in the years between the wars had not taken sufficient account of the past. The Belgian leaders saw with worried eyes the internal weakness of France and the vacillating pacifism of Britain. They clung to a strict neutrality. Even after Britain and France had entered into war, it was impossible to persuade them to rejoin the old alliance. They declared they would defend their neutrality to the death and place 9/10 of their forces on their German frontier, while at the same time they strictly forbade the Anglo-French army to enter their country and make effective preparations for their defense or for forestalling counterstrokes. The construction of new lines and the anti-tank ditch during the winter of 1939 by the British armies, with the French First Army on their right, along the Franco-Belgian frontier, had been the only measure open to us. It is a haunting question whether the whole policy of Plan D should not have been reviewed upon this basis, and whether we would not have been wiser to stand and fight on the French frontier, and amid these strong defenses, invite the Belgian army to fall back upon them, rather than make the hazardous and hurried forward leap to the Dyle or the Albert Canal. At the signal, the northern armies sprang to the rescue of Belgium and poured forward along all the roads amid the cheers of the inhabitants. The first phase of Plan D was completed by May the 12th. The French held the left bank of the Meuse to Huy, and their light forces beyond the river were falling back before increasing enemy pressure. So rapid had been the advance of the French 7th Army that it had already outrun its ammunition supplies. The superiority in quality, though not in numbers, of the British Air Force was already apparent. During the 14th, the bad news began to come in. At first, all was vague. At 7 p.m., I read to the Cabinet a message received from Monsieur Renault, stating that the Germans had broken through at Sedan, that the French were unable to resist the combination of tanks and dive bombing, and asking for 10 more squadrons of fighters to re-establish the line. Other messages received by the chiefs of staff gave similar information and added that both Generals Gamelin and George took a serious view of the situation, and that General Gamelin was surprised at the rapidity of the enemy's advance. All the British air squadrons fought continuously, their principal effort being against the pontoon bridges in the Sedan area. Several of these were destroyed and others damaged in desperate and devoted attacks. The losses in the low-level attacks on the bridges from the German anti-aircraft artillery were cruel. In one case of 6 aircraft, only 1 returned from the successful task. On this day alone, we lost a total of 67 machines, and being engaged principally with the enemy's anti-aircraft forces, accounted for only 53 German aircraft. That night, there remained in France of the Royal Air Force only 206 serviceable aircraft out of 474. At 7:30 on the morning of the 15th, I was woken up with the news that Monsieur Renault was on the telephone at my bedside. He spoke in English and evidently under stress. "We have been defeated." As I did not immediately respond, he said, "We are beaten. We have lost the battle." I said, Surely it can't have happened so soon. But he replied, the front is broken near Sedan. They are pouring through in great numbers with tanks and armored cars, or words to that effect. I then said, all experience shows that the offensive will come to an end after a while. I remember the 21st of March, 1918. After 5 or 6 days, they have to halt for supplies, and the opportunity for counterattack is presented. I learnt all this at the time from the lips of Marshal Foch himself. Certainly this was what we had always seen in the past, and what we ought to have seen now. However, the French Premier came back to the sentence with which he had begun, which proved indeed only too true. We are defeated. We have lost the battle. I said I was willing to come over and have a talk. On this day, the French 9th Army, Corps, was in a state of complete dissolution, and its remnants were divided up between General Giraud of the 7th French Army, who took over from Corap in the north, and the headquarters of the 6th French Army, which was forming in the south. A gap of some 50 miles had in fact been punched in the French line, through which the vast mass of enemy armor was pouring. Of course, this picture presented a general impression of defeat. I had seen a good deal of this sort of thing in the previous war, and the idea of the line being broken, even on a broad front, did not convey to my mind the appalling consequences that now flowed from it. Not having had access to official information for so many years, I did not comprehend the violence of the revolution effected since the last war by the incursion of a mass of fast-moving heavy armor. I knew about it, but it had not altered my inward convictions, as it should have done. There was nothing I could have done if it had. I rang up General George, who seemed quite cool, and reported that the breach at Sedan was being plugged. A telegram from General Gamelin also stated that although the position between Namur and Sedan was serious, he viewed the situation with calm. I reported Renault's message and other news to the cabinet at 11 a.m., the chiefs of staff being present. On the 16th, the German spearhead stood along the line La Capelle, Vervins, Marle, Lens, and the vanguards of the German 14th Corps were in support at Montcornet and Neufchâteau-sur-Aisne. The fall of Lens confirmed the penetration of over 60 miles inward upon us from the frontier near Sedan. Under this threat and the ever-increasing pressure on their own front, the 1st French Army and the British Expeditionary Force were ordered to withdraw in 3 stages to the Scheldt. Although none of these details were available, even to the War Office, and no clear view could be formed of what was happening, the gravity of the crisis was obvious. I felt it imperative to go to Paris that afternoon. At about 3 p.m., I flew to Paris in a Flamingo, a government passenger plane of which there were 3. General Dill, vice chief of the Imperial General Staff, came with me, and Ismay. It was a good machine, very comfortable, and making about 160 miles an hour. As it was unarmed, an escort was provided, but we soared off into a rain cloud and reached Le Bourget in little more than an hour. From the moment we got out of the Flamingo, it was obvious that the situation was incomparably worse than we had imagined. The officers who met us told General Ismay that the Germans were expected in Paris in a few days at most. After hearing at the embassy about the position, I drove to the Quai d'Orsay, arriving at 5:30 o'clock. I was conducted into one of its fine rooms. Renault was there, Daladier, Minister of National Defense and War, and General Gamelin. Everybody was standing. At no time did we sit down around a table. Utter dejection was written on every face. In front of Gamelin, on a student's easel, was a map about 2 yards square, with a black ink line purporting to show the Allied front. In this line there was drawn a small but sinister bulge at Sedan. The commander-in-chief briefly explained what had happened. North and south of Sedan, on a front of 50 or 60 miles, the Germans had broken through. The French army in front of them was destroyed or scattered. A heavy onrush of armored vehicles was advancing with unheard-of speed towards Amiens and Arras, with the intention, apparently, of reaching the coast at Abbeville or thereabouts. Alternatively, they might make for Paris. Behind the armor, he said, 8 or 10 German divisions, all motorized, were driving onwards, making flags for themselves as they advanced against the 2 disconnected French armies on either side. The general talked perhaps 5 minutes without anyone saying a word. When he stopped, there was a considerable silence. I then asked, where is the strategic reserve? And breaking into French, which I used indifferently in every sense, où est la masse de manœuvre? General Gamelin turned to me and with a shake of the head and a shrug said, aucune. There was another long pause. Outside in the garden of the Quai d'Orsay, clouds of smoke arose from large bonfires, and I saw from the window venerable officials pushing wheelbarrows of archives onto them. Already, therefore, the evacuation of Paris was being prepared. Past experience carries with its advantages the drawback that things never happen the same way again. Otherwise, I suppose life would be too easy. After all, we had often had our fronts broken before. Always we had been able to pull things together and wear down the momentum of the assault. But here were 2 new factors which I had never expected to have to face. First, the overrunning of the whole communications and countryside by an irresistible incursion of armored vehicles, and secondly, no strategic reserve. Aucune. I was dumbfounded. What were we to think of the great French army and its highest chiefs? It had never occurred to me that any commanders, having to defend 500 miles of engaged front, would have left themselves unprovided with a mass of maneuver. No one can defend with certainty so wide a front, but when the enemy has committed himself to a major thrust which breaks the line, one can always have, one must always have, a mass of divisions which marches up in vehement counterattack at the moment when the first fury of the offensive has spent its force. What was the Maginot Line for? It should have economized troops upon a large sector of the frontier, not only offering many sally ports for local counterstrokes, but also enabling large forces to be held in reserve. And this is the only way these things can be done. But now there was no reserve. I admit this was one of the greatest surprises I have had in my life. Why had I not known more about it, even though I had been so busy at the Admiralty? Why had the British government and the War Office, above all, not known more about it? It was no excuse that the French High Command would not impart their disposition to us, or to Lord Gort, except in vague outline. We had a right to know. We ought to have insisted. Both armies were fighting in the line together. I went back again to the window and to the curling wreaths of smoke from the bonfires of the state documents of the French Republic. Still the old gentlemen were bringing up their wheelbarrows and industriously casting their contents into the flames. Presently General Gamelin was speaking again. He was discussing whether forces should now be gathered to strike at the flanks of the penetration, or bulge, as we call such things later. 8 or 9 divisions were being withdrawn from quiet parts of the front and the Maginot Line. There were 2 or 3 armored divisions which had not been engaged. 8 or 9 more divisions were being brought from Africa and would arrive in the battle zone during the next fortnight or 3 weeks. General Giraud had been placed in command of the French army north of the Gap. The Germans would advance henceforward through a corridor between 2 fronts, on which warfare in the fashion of 1917 and 1918 could be waged. Perhaps the Germans could not maintain the corridor with its ever-increasing double-flank guards to be built up, and at the same time nourish their armored incursion. Something in this sense Gamelin seemed to say, and all this was quite sound. I was conscious, however, that he carried no conviction in this small but hitherto influential and responsible company. Presently I asked General Gamelin when and where he proposed to attack the flanks of the Bulge. His reply was, inferiority of numbers, inferiority of equipment, inferiority of method, and then a hopeless shrug of the shoulders. There was no argument. There was no need of argument. And where were we, the British, anyway, having regard to our tiny contribution, 10 divisions after 8 months of war, and not even 1 modern tank division in action? This was the last I saw of General Gamelin. He was a patriotic, well-meaning man and skilled in his profession, and no doubt he had his tale to tell. Far-reaching changes were now made by Mr. Renault in the French cabinet and high command. On the 18th, Marshal Pétain was appointed vice president of the council. Renault himself, transferring Daladier to foreign affairs, took over the Ministry of National Defense and War. At 7 p.m. on the 19th, he appointed Weygand, who had just arrived from the Levant, to replace General Gamelin. I had known Weygand when he was the right-hand man of Marshal Foch and had admired his masterly intervention in the Battle of Warsaw against the Bolshevik invasion of Poland in August 1920, an event decisive for Europe at that time. He was now 73, but was reported to be efficient and vigorous in a very high degree. At the morning war cabinet of the 20th of May, we again discussed the situation of our army, even on the assumption of a successful fighting retreat to the Somme. I thought it likely that considerable numbers might be cut off or driven back on the sea. It is recorded in the minutes of the meeting. The Prime Minister thought that as a precautionary measure, the Admiralty should assemble a large number of small vessels in readiness to proceed to ports and inlets on the French coast. On this, the Admiralty acted immediately and with ever-increasing vigor as the days passed and darkened. On the afternoon of the 20th, in consequence of orders from London, the first conference of all concerned, including representatives of the Shipping Ministry, was held at Dover to consider the emergency evacuation across the Channel of very large forces. These plans for what was called Operation Dynamo proved the salvation of the army 10 days later. The direction of the German thrust had now become more obvious. Armored vehicles and mechanized divisions continued to pour through the gap towards Amiens and Arras, curling westward along the Somme towards the sea. The German tanks, the dreaded Char Allemand, ranged freely through the open country and aided and supplied by mechanized transport, advanced 30 or 40 miles a day. They had passed through scores of towns and hundreds of villages without the slightest opposition, their officers looking out of the open cupolas and waving jauntily to the inhabitants. Eyewitnesses spoke of crowds of French prisoners marching along with them, many still carrying their rifles, which were from time to time collected and broken under the tanks. I was shocked by the utter failure to grapple with the German armor, which, with a few thousand vehicles, was compassing the entire destruction of mighty armies, and by the swift collapse of all French resistance once the fighting front had been pierced. Already on the 17th, I had asked the chief of the air staff, is there no possibility of finding out where a column of armored vehicles harbors during the dark hours, and then bombing? We are being ripped to pieces behind the front by these wandering columns. Weygand's first act was to cancel Gamelin's instruction number 12. It was not unnatural that he should wish to see the situation in the north for himself and to make contact with the commanders there. Allowances must be made for a general who takes over the command in the crisis of a losing battle. But now there was no time. He should not have left the summit of the remaining controls and have become involved in the delays and strains of personal movement. We may note what followed. On the morning of the 20th, Weygand, installed in Gamelin's place, made arrangements to visit the northern armies on the 21st. After learning that the roads to the north were cut by the Germans, he decided to fly. His plane was attacked and forced to land at Calais. The hour appointed for his conference at Ypres had to be altered to 3 p.m. on the 21st. Here he met King Leopold and General Billiot. Lord Gort, who had not been notified of time and place, was not present, and the only British officer in attendance was Admiral Keyes, who had no military command. The King described this conference as 4 hours of confused talking. It discussed the coordination of the three armies, the execution of the Weygand plan, and if that failed, the retirement of the British and French to the Lys, and the Belgians to the Yser. At 8 p.m., General Weygand had to leave. Lord Yacht did not arrive till 8 when he received an account of the proceedings from General Biot. Végan drove back to Calais, embarked on a submarine for Dieppe, and returned to Paris. Biot drove off in his car to deal with the crisis, and within an hour was killed in a motor collision. Thus all was again in suspense. Two fearsome alternatives therefore presented themselves to the War Cabinet. The first, the British Army at all costs, with or without French and Belgian cooperation, to cut its way to the south and to the Somme, a task which Lord Gort doubted its ability to perform. The second, to fall back on Dunkirk and face a sea evacuation under a hostile air attack, with the certainty of losing all the artillery and equipment then so scarce and precious. Obviously, great risk should be run to achieve the first, but there was no reason why all possible precautions and preparations should not be taken for the sea evacuation if the southern plan failed. I proposed to my colleagues that I should go to France to meet Reynaud and Végan and come to a decision. Dill was to meet me there from General George's headquarters. This was the moment when my colleagues felt it right to obtain from Parliament the extraordinary powers for which a bill had been prepared during the last 2 days. This measure would give the government practically unlimited power over the life, liberty, and property of all His Majesty's subjects in Great Britain. In general terms of law, the powers granted by Parliament were absolute. The Act was to include power by order in Council to make such defense regulations, making provision for requiring persons to place themselves, their services, and their property at the disposal of His Majesty as appeared to him necessary or expedient for securing the public safety, the defense of the realm, the maintenance of public order, or the efficient prosecution of any war in which His Majesty may be engaged, or for maintaining supplies or services essential to the life of the community. The bill was accordingly presented to Parliament on the afternoon of the 22nd by Mr. Chamberlain and Mr. Attlee, the latter himself moving the second reading. Both the Commons and the Lords, with their immense conservative majorities, passed it unanimously through all stages in a single afternoon, and it received the royal assent that night. The Romans in Rome's quarrel spared neither land nor gold, nor son nor wife, nor limb nor life, in the brave days of old. Such was the temper of the hour. When I arrived in Paris on May the 22nd, there was a new setting. Gamelin was gone. Daladier was gone from the war scene. Reynaud was both Prime Minister and Minister of War. As the German thrust had definitely turned seaward, Paris was not immediately threatened. Grand Quartier General was still at Vincennes. Monsieur Reynaud drove me down there about noon. In the garden, some of those figures I had seen round Gamelin, one a very tall cavalry officer, were pacing moodily up and down. "C'est l'ancien régime," remarked the aide-de-camp. Reynaud and I were brought into Végan's room and afterwards to the map room, where we had the great maps of the Supreme Command. Végan met us. In spite of his physical exertions and a night of travel, he was brisk, buoyant, and incisive. He made an excellent impression upon all. He unfolded his plan of war. He was not content with a southward march or retreat for the northern armies. They should strike southeast from around Cambrai and Arras in the general direction of Saint-Quentin, thus taking in flank the German armored divisions at present engaged in what he called the Saint-Quentin Amiens pocket. Their rear, he thought, would be protected by the Belgian army, which would cover them towards the east and, if necessary, towards the north. Meanwhile, a new French army under General Frere, composed of 18 to 20 divisions drawn from Alsace, from the Maginot Line, from Africa, and from every other quarter, were to form a front along the Somme. Their left hand would push forward through Amiens to Arras, and thus, by their utmost efforts, establish contact with the armies of the north. It will be seen that Végan's new plan did not differ, except in emphasis, from the cancelled instruction number 12 of General Gamelin, nor was it out of harmony with the vehement opinion which the War Cabinet had expressed on the 19th. the Northern Army were to shoulder their way southward by offensive action, destroying, if possible, the armored incursion. They were to be met by a helpful thrust through Amiens by the new French army group under General Frere. This would be most important if it came true. In private, I complained to Monsieur Renault that Gort had been left entirely without orders for 4 consecutive days. Even since Vagon had assumed command, 3 days had been lost in taking decisions. The change in the supreme command was right. The resultant delay was evil. We may now review up to this point the course of this memorable battle. Only Hitler was prepared to violate the neutrality of Belgium and Holland. Belgium would not invite the Allies in until she was herself attacked. Therefore, the military initiative rested with Hitler. On the 10th of May, he struck his blow. The first army group, with the British in the center, instead of standing behind their fortifications, leaped forward into Belgium on a vain, because belated, mission of rescue. The French had left the gap opposite the Ardennes, ill-fortified and weakly guarded. An armored inroad on a scale never known in war broke the center of the French line of armies and in 48 hours threatened to cut all the northern armies alike from their southern communications and from the sea. By the 14th at latest, the French high command should have given imperative orders to these armies to make a general retreat at full speed, accepting not only risks, but heavy losses of material. This issue was not faced in its brutal realism by General Gamelin. The French commander of the northern group was incapable of taking the necessary decisions himself. Confusion reigned throughout the armies of the threatened left wing. As the superior power of the enemy was felt, they fell back. As the turning movement swung round their right, they formed a defensive flank. If they had started back on the 14th, they could have been on their old line by the 17th and would have had a good chance of fighting their way out. At least 3 mortal days were lost. From the 17th onwards, the British War Cabinet saw clearly that an immediate fighting march southward would alone save the British Army. They were resolved to press their view upon the French government and General Gamelin, but their own commander, Lord Gort, was doubtful whether it was possible to disengage the fighting fronts, and still more to break through at the same time. On the 19th, General Gamelin was dismissed, and Vagon reigned in his stead. Gamelin's instruction number 12, his last order, though 5 days late, was sound in principle, and also in conformity with the main conclusions of the British War Cabinet and Chiefs of Staff. The change in the supreme command, or want of command, led to another 3 days' delay. The spirited plan which General Vagon proposed after visiting the northern armies was never more than a paper scheme. In the main, it was the Gamelin plan, rendered still more hopeless by further delay. In the hideous dilemma which now presented itself, we accepted the Vagon plan and made loyal and persistent, though now ineffectual, efforts to carry it out until the 25th, when all the communications being cut, our weak counterattack being repulsed with the loss of Arras, the Belgian front being broken, and King Leopold about to capitulate, all hope of escape to the southward vanished. There remained only the sea. Could we reach it, or must we be surrounded and broken up in the open field? In any case, the whole artillery and equipment of our army, irreplaceable for many months, must be lost. But what was that compared with saving the army, the nucleus and structure upon which alone Britain could build our armies of the future? Lord Gort, who had from the 25th onwards felt that evacuation by sea was our only chance, now proceeded to form a bridgehead around Dunkirk and to fight his way into it with what strength remained. All the discipline of the British and the qualities of their commanders, who included Brooke, Alexander, and Montgomery, were to be needed. Much more was to be needed. All that man could do was done. Would it be enough?
King Leopold capitulates. Winston Churchill's speech to the House of Commons, May 28, 1940.
The House will be aware
that the King of the Belgians yesterday sent a plenipotentiary to the German command asking for a suspension of arms on the Belgian front. The British and French governments instructed their generals immediately to dissociate themselves from this procedure and to persevere in the operations in which they are now engaged. However, the German command has agreed to the Belgian proposals, and the Belgian army ceased to resist the enemy's will at 4 o'clock this morning. I have no intention of suggesting to the House that we should attempt at this moment to pass judgment upon the action of the King of the Belgians in his capacity as Commander-in-Chief of the Belgian Army. This army has fought very bravely and has both suffered and inflicted heavy losses. The Belgian government has dissociated itself from the action of the King and, declaring itself to be the only legal government of Belgium, has formally announced its resolve to continue the war at the side of the Allies who have come to the aid of Belgium at our urgent appeal. The situation of the British and French armies now engaged in a most severe battle and beset on three sides and from the air is evidently extremely grave. The surrender of the Belgian army in this manner adds appreciably to their grievous peril. I expect to make a statement to the House on the general position when the result of the intense struggle now going on can be known and measured. This will not, perhaps, be until the beginning of next week. Meanwhile, Mr. Speaker, the House should prepare itself for hard and heavy tidings. I have only to add that nothing which may happen in this battle can in any way relieve us of our duty to defend the world cause to which we have vowed ourselves. Nor should it destroy our confidence in our power to make our way, as on former occasions in our history, through disaster and through grief, to the ultimate defeat of our enemies.
Chapter 5, The Second World War. The deliverance of Dunkirk.
There was a short service of intercession and prayer in Westminster Abbey. The English are loath to expose their feelings, but in my stall in the choir, I could feel the pent-up, passionate emotion, and also the fear of the congregation, not of death or wounds or material loss, but of defeat and the final ruin of Britain. It was Tuesday, the 28th of May, and I did not attend the House until that day week. There was no advantage to be gained by a further statement in the interval, nor did members express a wish for one. But everyone realized that the fate of our army, and perhaps much else, might well be decided by then. I had not seen many of my colleagues outside the War Cabinet, except individually, since the formation of the government, and I thought it right to have a meeting in my room at the House of Commons of all ministers of cabinet rank other than the War Cabinet members. We were perhaps 25 round the table. I described the course of events, and I showed them plainly where we were and all that was in the balance. Then I said quite casually, and not treating it as a point of special significance, "Of course, whatever happens at Dunkirk, we shall fight on." There occurred a demonstration which, considering the character of the gathering, 25 experienced politicians and parliament men who represented all the different points of view, whether right or wrong, before the war, surprised me. Quite a number seemed to jump up from the table and come running to my chair, shouting and patting me on the back. There is no doubt that had I at this juncture faltered at all in the leading of the nation, I should have been hurled out of office. I was sure that every minister was ready to be killed quite soon and have all his family and possessions destroyed, rather than give in. In this they represented the House of Commons and almost all the people. It fell to me in these coming days and months to express their sentiments on suitable occasions. This I was able to do because they were mine also. There was a white glow, overpowering, sublime, which ran through our island from end to end. The Admiralty did not hesitate to give full rein to the spontaneous movement which swept the seafaring population of our south and southeastern shores. Everyone who had a boat of any kind, steam or sail, put out for Dunkirk, and the preparations, fortunately begun a week earlier, were now aided by the brilliant improvisation of volunteers on an amazing scale. The numbers arriving on the 29th were small, but they were the forerunners of nearly 400 small craft, which from the 31st were destined to play a vital part by ferrying from the beaches to the off-lying ships almost 100,000 men. Altogether, there came to the rescue of the army under the ceaseless air bombardment of the enemy about 850 vessels, of which nearly 700 were British and the rest Allied.